Welcome to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Great music on the show today. We'll explore Beethoven and his phenomenal violin concerto with someone who knows a thing or two on the topic, renowned violinist Dmitri Sitkovetsky. He spent the last 34 years of his life turning this forbidding mountain of a piece into an old friend. Then we'll get right with the Get Right Band and jump from Beethoven to blues, reggae, rock, ska, just about every musical style in between, and they're getting it just right. We'll shift gears with an unusual scavenger hunt. Curators Joe Pickett and Nick Prewer will leave no stone unturned in their North American quest for videos. The Found Footage Festival showcases their fascinating VHS finds. And we return full circle today with violin and composer-violinist Daniel Pappas. Got any road trip plans this weekend? Daniel's got you covered with an enticing CD of original electronic and acoustic instrumental music that's just perfect for thoughtful reflection on the road. Coming up next on Triad Arts Weekend after this news. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Later this hour, Eddie Garcia previews the Found Footage Festival, and we've got lots and lots of wonderful and unusual sounds for you, too, beginning with the wonderful world of Western classical music. In April of 2002, a renowned Russian violinist was invited to perform Beethoven's Concerto for Violin with the Greensboro Symphony. That performance left a lasting impression. The chemistry between soloist and orchestra was just right, and the following year, the guest artist was appointed music director of the Greensboro Symphony Orchestra. It's a position Dmitri Sitkovetsky holds to this day, and this week, the internationally acclaimed violinist joins the orchestra once more as soloist, performing Beethoven's amazing concerto. Dmitri has lived with this musically and technically demanding piece for decades, performing it with orchestras all over the world. His 2005 recording of Beethoven's violin concerto with Sir Neville Mariner in the Academy of St. Martin in the Fields received excellent reviews, and we'll be sampling from it throughout our interview. Dmitri spoke with me by phone from his studio in London. Beethoven composed this concerto while in his mid-30s. What sorts of things marked his compositional style at about this time in his life, Dmitri? How do they spill out into this work?
Well, I think Beethoven went through, of course, probably more than any other composers, through different stages of his life, depending on all the different struggles that he had. You know, of course, the continued struggle was with his hearing. And he was a titanic character, and so his crises were also titanic. But now and then, he would be in a much more peaceful frame of mind. They're very precious, those moments, and I think the violin concerto carries a lot of those. Maybe that's why today it took on a greater significance, maybe, than any of the piano concerto, and it sort of stands certainly at the summit of the violin repertoire, because there, in the violin part, altogether, there is hardly any conflict or Sturm und Drang, you know, any kind of stormy Beethoven that you think you know what music of Beethoven. One never really knows all of Beethoven because he was so many things. But when he had that peacefulness in him and he finally found his way to heaven or to the peace inside of himself, he was just absolutely divine. And I think this concerto, and especially, of course, the second movement, just represents something very precious, even out of everything that he wrote.
And unfortunately for poor Beethoven, it was a short-lived peace of mind. I've read a few juicy stories about the premiere of this concerto by Beethoven's good friend Franz Clement, beginning with Clement having to actually sight-read large sections in that performance. Is that true or false? And could you fill us in on how it fell upon folks like Joachim and later Mendelssohn to sort of rescue this work from oblivion?
I think that the history of the first performance was disastrous. And of course, not to a small measure was Beethoven's fault, because he was always so late in writing, you know, delivering the score. And so the performer, really, the violinist, had to literally just sight read. And then he felt he had to entertain the audience between the first and second movement. He played a piece of his own, holding violin upside down. And of course, today you cannot even think of a greater sacrilege than to do. But I guess in those days, rules and whichever worked for the public success was employed. So Beethoven was absolutely furious with the results, and he thought that he had given a stillbirth. In other words, he immediately, very soon after that, I think he made it for the piano. He made a version for the piano, wrote a cadenza with timpani in it, and that's it. And that was the last he heard of that concerto.
It's unbelievable. I could do a whole show on just the first and almost, you know, pieces that were just almost lost forever and disastrous beginnings.
I mean, surprisingly enough, another incredibly popular violin concerto suffered almost the same fate. And that's Tchaikovsky violin concerto. It was a disaster, the premiere, horrible review. Tchaikovsky never heard it again, even though it was played again, I think, in London, but he wouldn't even dare to go there. So that's it. And only after his death, Auer felt guilty that he'd rejected the concerto, and then he gave it to all of his great students, and they made it popular. They were all playing it, and it became also one of the most popular violin concerto, but not that Tchaikovsky ever knew of that. So Beethoven, actually, only posthumously, because of such an incredible figure as Joachim, and of course Mendelssohn, who was probably the greatest genius composer who promoted the music of the others as much as his own, maybe even more. So he brought back, of course, Bach had a revival. We probably would have never known Johann Sebastian Bach if it weren't for Mendelssohn. And so many other great pieces, like Schubert's Great Symphony was first performed by Mendelssohn, all posthumously. And so Beethoven Concerto was also one of the pieces he conducted. But of course, Joachim took it everywhere, and he played it, and he made it a popular. And then finally, you know, the audience realized that was an incredible piece of music. And it stood at the summit of violin repertoire ever since.
From your perspective as a performer, conductor, composer, arranger, why has this concerto become such a player's favorite?
You know, I would not say it's the player's favorite because it's incredibly difficult. He never really cared about, I think it belonged to him, the phrase. He said, "Who cares about the damn fiddle when the inspiration visits me?" Something like that.
Right.
He said that. And it's true. He really didn't care about the comfort. Brahms was a lot more conscious of that and consulted Joachim, of all people, very often to make it more violinistic. And, you know, Mendelssohn certainly wrote the most perfect violin concerto. Beethoven is not perfectly written for the violin because of a lot of it is pianistic writing, to tell you the truth. But it's such an incredible story. It's such an incredible piece of music. So compelling. The second movement is so divine. The first movement is epic, really, just an incredible. It could have been a concerto in itself. But then the second movement just takes you completely to heaven. And then the last movement is so full of vigor and fun and humor and beauty. And it's just a sensational piece. I believe it's the best concerto Beethoven ever wrote for any instrument.
I find that when people say, some critics, they're out there, they say, oh, Beethoven couldn't write a melody. You just say, well, listen to the Larghetto from this concerto. I mean, it's some just beautiful.
Are you kidding? Oh, my goodness. I mean, and it's, you know, my favorite cadenza to this concerto is by Fritz Kreisler. I mean, what he does, which is a stroke of genius, he combines two themes of the first movement into a double stop, double melody in the violin solo. It's quite extraordinary, and they fit so perfectly well. Probably one of the most melodic pieces Beethoven ever wrote. And as I said, in the violin part, all the more dramatic or more bigger gestures in the first movement, they all belong to the orchestra. Violin never really has all that Sturm und Drang in its part. It's very, very lyrical. It's very unlike your sort of archetype Beethoven kind of music.
I got a chance to see and hear your performance. This is on YouTube. Thank goodness for YouTube, of the famous third movement, Rondo Allegro with the NHK Orchestra. Was another Dmitri conducting, Dmitri Kitayenko.
Yes.
Yeah. First off, I just love the tempo that you lock in on that. Not too fast, not too slow. How do you get that just right? I mean, how do you make those decisions, you know, leading up to that performance in the moment?
Well, it's, you know, finding the right tempo, and in general in music, the question of rhythm and the pulse and the tempo very often is more important than actually having an absolute pitch or a perfect pitch, whatever they call it. And it is something that you have to have inside of you. And I think also for a conductor, the memory for tempi is one of the most important qualities to have. And being sort of a performer, conductor, for me, finding the right tempo and keeping it. You have to have a tremendous amount of homework done, but then when you come out, you have to feel the hall. You have to feel the audience, and sometimes you speed up certain things, and sometimes you slow down certain things, or you keep exactly the one that you brought out. It also depends on your pulse, you know, how excited, nervous, or you know, whatever your state of mind, that all comes into consideration, and it affects one's performance.
I want to get off the stage for just a moment with you, Dmitri, and get into the recording studio, because 5 years later, you recorded this concerto with Sir Neville Mariner, the Academy of St. Martin in the Fields. Do you prepare differently for a recording session than for a live situation?
Yes and no. Yes, because, you know, in the recording situation, especially these days, you can't afford not to be perfect. While in a live performance, you can create an illusion of being perfect, but when you listen to the tape, it's actually not perfect. And if you, in a live concert, if you're trying to be perfect, you'll miss other important elements, spontaneity and risk-taking and all of that. But in the recording situation, where you have to have that lively feeling, like it is a live performance, I can't really listen to recordings that are so clearly just the recording.
How has your conception of the piece changed then over the, I mean, this is the 35 year history with this piece. Could you give us an example or two of how it's, you know, evolved over that time?
Well, I think one gets so much more familiar with the piece. It becomes your friend, your companion, or, you know, you're no longer just looking up so your neck hurts. You know, when you look up at the big mountain, your neck begins to hurt. You're always looking up. You know, so you sort of more on level terms, you feel more familiar. It's not so, you know, it seems like such an impossible task when you're just beginning to play. The first, I don't know, probably first 10 times at least, it's always daunting, you know, that concerto. But as you get closer to it and you feel familiar, it's sort of like a role that you've played. You know, if you've played Hamlet, I don't know, 100 times, you certainly found things there, and it's all in small. Devil is always in the detail, and genius is also in detail, in small things. It's not that I'm going to turn things upside down and, you know, and do it dramatically different. No, but it's the smaller things, and in my case, I think I'm interacting with every instrument, with every section, so much more now than I used to do it when I first started playing it. That I think that affects and enriches my playing, I think, a great deal, because I could react and respond to all the wonderful players there, and it gives me more impulses and ideas, and my responses are a lot more interesting over the years. So it very much depends on the company I keep.
Thank you. The amount of rubato that you choose always seems so well thought out, and I'm just wondering if you could maybe describe, for non-musicians out there, describe rubato and how you make those decisions.
Yeah, well, if you think I take a lot of rubato on that recording, you ain't seen nothing yet. I mean, I take a lot more chances now and a lot more rubato, because I command the time a lot better now in my, you know, mature years. Because, you see, music does not consist of sounds only. Music consists of sounds and silence, air that's between those notes. And sometimes there are pauses and breaks between those notes are actually more meaningful than the notes themselves. It's sort of like in life, you know, when you have an answer, so you have something concrete. But when you have a question, that propels one's development. You always should ask questions and question what you do and all that. So those, the air between the notes and the way there are questions, that creates the atmosphere. And the true masters of the performance, of live performance, are the ones who are the masters of time. Because notes could be learned by a 12-year-old prodigy. He or she plays those notes perfectly. And it's very amusing and it's very impressive. But that person, I can assure you, has no concept of time yet. And it's perfectly natural. People think they've got all the time in the world. But as you grow older, you realize that the time is a very particular commodity. And you develop your own relationship with it. And then when it's applied to music, if you are the master of time, something magical happens. If you're not, you'll just play beautifully.
As for, last week, I had a conversation with a former semi-professional soccer player, and there was soccer on TV. I'm not a great player, but I'm an admirer, and I asked him what he admired about this great athlete on the TV screen, and he said he slows time down.
I see a similar. It's true. I'm a huge soccer fan, of course. I call it football here, and I go to matches. I can talk for hours with you, but it's exactly the same principle in many ways, because... And Michael Jordan, you remember how he used to just be suspended in the air. But I often use football analogies. For instance, like a conductor having a score is one of the biggest advantages and requirements. Is you can sort of, what I call, you have to see the field. In other words, the whole journey from the beginning to the end. It's like the greatest players, they always see everything else. It's not enough that they have great technique and they can dribble, but they see what else is going on the field. They never even look at the ball. The ball seems to be permanently attached to their feet. God knows how, but they always look who else is available and what else is happening, and they see the combination two or three moves ahead. So it could be very much, as you said, you know, it's the time. He slows down the time, and he has this extra moment to do extraordinary things. It's very similar.
Let me ask you this, because we talked about your conception of the piece is not, I mean, you don't dramatically alter the perception of the piece, but how you approach it, the interaction with the musicians,
right.
More so now, the master of time and rubato. But could you give me a primary personal goal, with this upcoming performance, or what you feel like you need to do in order to be satisfied with your performance of this concerto?
Well, I think, in any case, you know, I just had a really special performance in Bologna, just on the 19th of December, where I played the Beethoven, having not played it for 4.5 years, I think, before that. And that went exceptionally well. With the orchestra, I never performed before, and so with the conductor, I never performed before. So those things normally, you know, carry inside potential dangers. So, you know, here I have a very familiar situation. It's an orchestra I've been closest for the last 10 years, closer than to any other orchestra, and spend more time on stage. And the conductor that I worked with before in the Brahms, but also who's always near me whenever I'm in Greensboro. So I have such familiar situations, and the halls I know very well. But I'm not taking anything for granted, because just as in Bologna, there were two unknown factors, so it could have gone wrong, but it didn't. Here is a danger that familiarity could sometimes backfire. And just when you think, oh, here I'm at home and it should be, you know. So I'll be even more on my toes, because I'll be looking for enhancing the performance that I just had last month, rather than just, oh, it just went so well, so it must go well at home. No, I think it's more responsibility. You're playing for the home crowd. You have to rise to a different level. And if I'm able also to take all my friends, musicians of the orchestra, Nate, on a special journey with me to the spheres which are sometimes quite familiar to me, I'll be very happy.
Well, I'm very happy. Thank you for talking with me.
Great, David. Thanks so much. Always such a pleasure to talk to you.
Internationally acclaimed violinist, recording artist, arranger, and music director of the Greensboro Symphony Orchestra, Maestro Dmitri Sitkovetsky. On Saturday night, January 25th at 8 o'clock in Dana Auditorium, he'll join the orchestra as soloist in a performance of Beethoven's Violin Concerto, Opus 61. We've been sampling from Dmitri's 2005 recording of the work with Sir Neville Mariner and the Academy of St. Martin in the Fields. It's available on the Virgin label, and you'll find links on our website, WFDD.org, and click on Triad Arts Weekend. This weekend's GSO performance, titled Diamonds in the Rough, also includes the monumental Symphony No. 5 by Jean Sibelius. You'll find links to ticket information and more on our website. Again, that's WFDD.org, and click on Triad Arts Weekend. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and after this short break, we're going to get right with some more music. The Get Right Band is here with a preview of their upcoming gig at Bull's Tavern in Winston-Salem. But first, they've got to pack up their bags and schlep it on home from their tough gig in the Caribbean next, when Triad Arts Weekend continues. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and we've got a little night music with composer Daniel Pappas on the way. We'll scour the yard sales and do some dumpster diving for an eclectic mix of home videos with Eddie Garcia. But first, it's time to get right. The Asheville-based funk, rock, reggae band, The Get Right Band, is guitarist-singer Silas DeRocher, his longtime bassist pal Jesse Gentry, and drummer Chris Pyle. And yes, if the words drummer and Pyle ring a bell, turns out that Chris is related to rock and roll royalty. His dad is former Lynyrd Skynyrd drummer Thomas Delmer Artemus Pyle. Get Right's got a new album out, The Get Right Band, and they'll bring several selections to the Triad next weekend at Bull's Tavern in Winston-Salem, Friday night, January 31st at 10 o'clock. But first, they'll need to pack up their gear and head home from St. Thomas Island in the Caribbean. It was there that I caught up with the band huddled around their cell phone. Tell me about playing in the Caribbean, Jesse. What's that experience like? You know, the good, bad, and the ugly.
Fantastic. I mean, it's everything you hope and dream it would be. You know, it's fantastically beautiful. Everybody here loves music. But some of the negatives are a lot of the gear down here has seen certainly some better and less salty and sandy days. But that's kind of the fun of it. You never know what you're going to get.
You're speaking to a lifelong bass fan, and I really enjoyed the next tune in this line of videos that were sent my way, Shut Your Mouth. And you start that off with a really nice, just a great funky bass groove. Who are some of your bass idols, Jesse?
Oh, man. Well, my number one idol is probably Jaco Pastorius. But I grew up listening to Les Claypool and Flea. Those were my top two growing up.
Yeah.
Basically, those three are probably my top influences.
Like you gon' be by my side this time next year.
you've got a great bass sound. Talk about the writing of this one. I love that line. You best be careful what you promised me. I got a darn good memory. Some great lyrics to some of these tunes. How do you guys collaborate on the writing?
Majority of the songwriting, Silas does. I wrote a few of the tunes. He does the bulk of the songwriting. That tune, another one of those tunes that everybody can kind of relate to. I mean, everybody fantasizes about saying those words to, you know, people in their lives. It's a satisfying song to play and to be a part of.
I should say a very nice little guitar solo in the midst of that as well, and some nice guitar work.
Yeah, he shreds it. The man can shred.
My guitar and my girl by my side, and it feels so right. I was never looking for anything more than this.
Well, Get Right, it seemed like an ode to life's simple pleasures there. I liked it. I enjoyed that.
Yeah, it's a very feel-good song, and one that I feel the music definitely helps to bring the lyrics to life.
Well, it certainly shows off a lot of styles, and I you know, great intro with that fretless bass, right into a quick ska groove. You kind of tease out the ska for a moment before dipping back into that, into reggae later on. What are some of your other influences?
We got JC, our drummer here. You want to handle that?
I'll say one thing about the influences, but in terms of showcasing that the style that this band goes through, I think that's not only is that song called Get Right, but it showcases all the styles that we touch on in many of the tunes. So kind of odd that the song might be titled that, you know, as well as the band. But I can't speak so much for Jesse and Silas's personal influences, but I can say on the drums, my own, I was heavily influenced by John Bonham, Tony Williams, Billy Cobham, you know, a lot of those jazz fusion guys in the 70s. And then a lot of modern stuff, mostly, you know, drawing from rock a lot, but then studying reggae and studying ska and studying jazz. I think it makes for a really interesting mix of genres and styles, but all the while, you know, trying to keep everybody moving on the dance floor.
Sometimes that's tough to finesse. I've heard a lot of bands kind of flirt with different styles, but it sounds almost cliche-ish. When you dive right into it, though, and you play as well as you do, it's really powerful stuff. It must be fun to get to kind of explore all these styles and make it your own.
It makes everything more fun and more diverse for us. It's, you know, if going to a job and doing the same thing every day, it's eventually going to lose its luster. But if every single night we're playing a myriad of genres and playing different songs, different styles every night, it keeps us happy. It keeps everybody satisfied. People that have seen us before are never going to see the same show twice. Just makes everybody happier and makes the vibe a lot better. And, you know, there's something for everyone. And like we like to think that we're pretty good musicians, so whenever we tackle a different style, we try to, you know, give it all we've got, so to speak. And as far as the ska goes, I mean, if people aren't dancing, you just got to throw a little ska at them and just, you know, if that's not going to get them up and moving, you know, we'll try the next style after that, but I usually get the job done.
Well, you go to the next style with the next tune that I heard, at least, with Dancing Shoes, and man, some great just retro funk, James Brown, Red Hot Chili Peppers, everything thrown out that way, and you make it look easy, Jesse and Chris, I mean, but I know it's not. How long did it take to get that tune together? It's a great tune.
Yeah, with this band, really, it doesn't take us long to get stuff together, but that tune has come along very nicely ever since we first started playing it. It's just a funk powerhouse, and everybody gives it their own treatment. Every time we play it, it just comes alive, and it's a magical time.
From the new album, give me a cut off the new album that you're particularly pleased with.
Probably Touch the Holy, right, JC? That song, it embodies, it's about the islands. It was actually written this time last year when we were down in the Virgin Islands, and it's just kind of like a reggae tune, but it really has kind of its own feel to it. It just kind of flows from one style to the next, and it's very easy to listen to, but still kind of showcases our just rock-solid beat and nice melodies over top.
Under the heart-shaped shade of a maho tree,
holy.
The Get Right Band is bassist Jesse Gentry, drummer Chris Pyle, and guitarist-singer Silas DeRocher. We're sampling from their new self-titled album, and you'll find links at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. You can hear the band live in Brevard at the Phoenix on Tuesday night, the 28th, beginning at 8 o'clock, and they'll be in concert Friday night, January 31st at 10 o'clock at Bull's Tavern in Winston-Salem.
Kiss of a cactus fruit. We touch the holy.
This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and we're off on an unusual cinematic scavenger hunt with Eddie Garcia.
The Found Footage Festival showcases videos found at garage sales, thrift stores, and dumpsters throughout North America. Curators Joe Pickett and Nick Prewer take audiences on a guided tour of their latest VHS finds, providing live commentary and Where Are They Now updates on the people in these entertaining videos. The Found Footage Festival celebrates its 10th anniversary with a brand new show and tour, kicking off in Raleigh on January 29th and in Greensboro on Thursday, January 30th at 7:30 p.m. at the Geeksboro Coffeehouse Cinema. Check wfdd.org/triadarts for tickets and more info. I spoke with co-founder Nick Prewer and got some insight into their VHS digging habits.
First name.
How do you know what to buy or, you know, how to dig for the gem? Or do you not? Or you just keep digging until you strike lucky?
Yeah, it is kind of a stab in the dark to know what's going to be good when you just see a tape at a thrift store. We've gotten a little bit better batting average over the years just because we've seen so many videos that you kind of have a good idea, like, okay, there's a celebrity on this one. It's probably worth watching. Or this is a hand-labeled tape that looks like it could have something good on it. But you never know. You just have to ultimately pop it in, sit down, settle in, and hope that there's something good on it.
What do you think it is that draws you to these fringe videos?
I guess the strangeness and the sort of unpolishedness to it, especially nowadays where anybody who has a webcam can make a video. There's a lot of stuff out there. But what's unique about sort of the VHS era is that there was a lack of self-awareness at the time. There's kind of a wide-eyed innocence about it, too. People were just throwing ideas at a wall and seeing what stuck. And because of that, you get some really strange things. Not only strange outfits and, you know, video toaster effects and things like that, but strange concepts. Like, you know, there's a video we found a few years ago called Rent a Friend, which was for lonely people. You could pop this tape in and the guy would be your virtual friend for an hour. Video fireplaces and video board games. So it was just a strange landscape. So, yeah, you kind of had these mom-and-pop operations, people who may not have had any business in front of a camera or behind it making videos.
All right, so maybe to give listeners a better sense of what to expect, let's play a clip.
Let's pretend to be dogs for a little bit, okay? Here we go.
Whatever.
You're a dog. You're hungry. However would you do that? Or, let me hear it. Okay.
Get out there and perform.
And you too can have fun with ventriloquism.
This could have launched a lot of ventriloquism careers. I mean, maybe that guy Jeff Dunham was in the audience.
Yeah, you never know. Some budding ventriloquists might have gotten their start here. Yeah, I wanted to be a ventriloquist when I grew up. And so I was at a Goodwill in Atlantic City, New Jersey a few years ago and found
the entire top row of their VHS section was all learning ventriloquism
no,
videos.
That's
and
crazy.
We just imagined some kid finally gave up the dream, you know, off to the Goodwill.
We'll post a link on our site, and the visual is really recommended in this instance because, you know, quite interesting looking audience members.
Definitely a Motley Crue there in the audience.
I've got another clip that you sent me, Totally Tulip. Before I play it, you want to tell us a little bit about this?
Yeah, this is from 1988, and it's a tulip paints were like fabric paints that you'd use to make puffy designs on your sweatshirt. And so this is an instructional video by that company about how to tulip paint your sweatshirts to make them fun. And perplexingly, it opens with a 3.5-minute music video with an original song.
All right, let's give that a listen.
Happy tulip colors make me feel like dancing, playing in the sunlight, dancing in the moonlight, feeling tulip, totally tulip, feeling tulip,
talking tulip,
totally tulip.
Wow.
Well,
yeah, wow.
Wow, indeed.
Yeah, and the visuals for this song, that's part of a montage we're doing called Songs That Will Get Stuck in Your Head Forever. And
no.
That one has been in our head ever since we found that video in Dallas last year. So we're going to subject audience members to that now, too. You know, we're a bit masochistic in that we subject ourselves to all these videos. And yeah. Whenever possible, we like to give people a little taste of that as well.
With what you guys do, with us being in the age of YouTube, there's no shortage of entertaining videos. We get sent links to funny videos. There are shows like Tosh.0. So what is it that sets the Found Footage Festival and its clips apart?
We don't take any videos off the internet. And I think part of the reason is because it's already out there. But the other reason is there is something unique about all the VHS, that era. For us, part of the thrill is the discovery. So in addition to what's on the tape, like at the shows, we provide the backstory, and we'll track down people in the videos and play our interviews with them at the shows. So we really kind of take it a step beyond something you get on your inbox and then forget about. But the other thing I think that people sometimes forget is how entertaining it is to be in a big room full of people and watch something, especially something that wasn't meant to be shown in public, mm-hmm. like an exercise video or a training video. Something magical happens, and something you don't get on a little 2-inch window on your laptop. It's far more entertaining to be in a dark theater with 200 other people watching this stuff.
Nick Prewer, co-founder of the Found Footage Festival. The collection of comedic gems hits Greensboro on January 30th at the Geeksboro Coffeehouse Cinema. Check wfdd.org/triadarts for tickets and more info. For WFDD, I'm Eddie Garcia.
This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. We're going to take another short break and return with music to drive by. Driving at Night is the new album by Triad-based composer Daniel Pappas. Just about 60 seconds from now, stay with us. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Composer Daniel C. Pappas is widely performed throughout the U.S. and Europe. His music runs the gamut: orchestral works, chamber music, solo and electro-acoustic music. He's been featured in new music festivals, won awards for several of his works, including his orchestral piece, The Silence About Heaven, which enjoyed a successful German premiere in 2006. Daniel's taught at the University of North Carolina at Greensboro, Guilford Tech Community College, and the University of South Carolina, where he received an award for excellence in teaching undergrads. Daniel's also active as a contracted television composer for most all major networks, and his music regularly appears on shows like Good Morning America, World News with Diane Sawyer, and 2020. Lately, though, Daniel's strayed from his classical roots with dance tracks, indie pop, and music that falls in between the cracks. His latest collection of original compositions can be found on his new CD, Driving at Night, which includes electronic elements, along with fine acoustic performances by cellist Gina Pezzoli, oboist Thomas Pappas, that's Daniel's brother, and some nice violin lines contributed by the composer himself, Daniel Pappas. Why do you compose music?
That's a good question. I ask that myself when I look at my bank account sometimes. But I think when I first heard a piece of mine that I wrote, that was the moment when I realized there's nothing better than that moment when you experience it. And the first piece was really just a four-part chorale-style theory exercise in college. And hearing it back and realizing that I just created something that wasn't there before, I just expressed something new that nobody else had expressed yet. I teach, or I taught up until this past semester, music theory at Guilford Tech Community College. And the students in my Theory 2 class, I'd make the final project a composition project. And so that was also the final exam. I watch their faces as they hear their pieces being played. And I can tell they're having that same experience that I've been having. And so I think that's one reason why I write. It's really just so self-satisfying.
You got an award for excellence in teaching undergrads at the University of South Carolina. Beyond sharing that oral experience with the student for the first time, hearing his or her own work, what are some other teaching goals that you set up for yourself when you're reaching out to students?
When you have music majors or people that are interested in a music career, what's been really important to me is getting them to start thinking very early on about entrepreneurship. These days, if you want to be involved in the arts or if you want to be involved in, you know, even music technology, you're a self-starter. You control your own destiny and your own career.
Well, you're living proof of the importance of networking and having that business savvy or entrepreneurship savvy, referencing your television compositional career and having written for most major networks. How do you get into that business per se? And it's a very competitive business, a very competitive world. And what sorts of musical contributions have you made along those lines?
Yeah. When it comes to writing for TV, I think you have to have a connection. Cold calling is probably not going to get you very far. I happen to have a cousin of my father, so I guess it'd be my second cousin. He is a composer for the networks. He lives out in Hollywood, and he had a project he couldn't do. And although I was extremely busy, the one thing I did learn is you never say no. That's something I tell my students all the time. If you get an opportunity and you know that you could probably figure out how to do it, now don't say yes to something you have no idea how to do, but you say yes and you do it and you make it happen. And if that means you stay up for a week and you don't sleep, you do it. And I think that was my first job. And I literally stayed up all night for almost a week just trying to get my schoolwork done and writing this music. It was used for the royal wedding that was happening a couple years ago. Good Morning America needed music for all their little royal segments, and that's basically the music I started writing first.
How about that?
Yeah.
Necessity, the mother of invention.
That's right.
Yeah. How is it different? This use of your talent, your music, different, and what are some of the challenges you face beyond just having to get the job done in time?
Yeah, it's actually quite different. It's something that took me a while to pick up on. I think with my music, I tend not to front load. And by front load, I mean from the very moment it starts, it has to be extremely interesting. So TV music has to be front loaded. If you have something exciting, it all needs to happen in the first 5 to 10 seconds. Not because they just need that type of music, but they're only going to listen to the first 5 to 10 seconds. And if they aren't immediately struck by it, they don't want the music. Now, they do need more calm and subtle moments, but you're going to put those towards the back end. And that's exactly the opposite in the way I write my own music. So it took me a while to catch on to that. I kept getting it sent back for revision, and I couldn't figure out why, and that was why.
It's very very similar in good radio journalism. They you want to hear the bite early, the one that's the grabber. What would be one that you're particularly proud of, Daniel, in terms of writing for television?
One piece that I felt like I put a lot of work and effort into, it was a little segment about the plight of Native Americans on the reservations that was on the nightly news. The process of writing it was interesting. I wrote my first draft. I thought it was great. I thought it really expressed what they were after. I got a revision back saying that they want something completely different. I rewrote it. I sent it back. They said, okay. Then Diane Sawyer listened to it. She said she didn't like it. They played her the original one that I had done, and then that one was perfect. So, you know, there's too many ears, and you tend to rewrite things 10 times, and then they end up coming back to the first one. But that's just part of the business, and it's kind of fun.
So Driving at Night, quoting you here, a soundtrack to all the quiet thoughts that accompany the solitary driver with all of his or her hopes and fears. What was the composition process like for Driving at Night? What were some building blocks for these pieces?
I wanted to write music that was always the highlight moment. From start to finish, each movement was something that I enjoyed every single second of. I feel that certain composers sometimes fill the time, space, and I didn't want to do that with this music. So I really wanted it from the beginning of the piece to the end. I wanted it to capture the listener. I want the listener to kind of get lost. And the title came about, I was driving home from UNCG to my apartment every day late at night after long days of work. On those nights, that was the time for me to process the day. It was time for me to think about what was going to come the next day before I got home and just went straight to bed. So it was really the only free time that I had to kind of digest what had just happened and what was going on, my hopes, my fears. And I was in search of this new concert hall when I actually started writing the album. I was having a hard time getting my music performed. It didn't seem to really fit the concert hall quite as well. People weren't asking me to write this kind of music for them. I don't think many people have the patience to sit down and listen quietly to a piece of music that's longer than 2 minutes. And I thought, you know, where's the one place where people will not have anything else to do, where they just sit quietly? And I thought, you know, in your car, you're just there by yourself. There's nobody with you, and you're just listening to music, and you're letting it wash over you. And I felt like that'd be the perfect place to kind of catch people with it.
Well, from the very beginning, there's some really ethereal, atmospheric sounds. From the beginning of the tune, do you start then with a color or a backdrop of sound like that, or does the melody come first? Or talk me through the process on one of these
That's
works.
A good question. I usually have a two-step process when I compose. The first is begrudgingly sit myself down and start working. I always happen to know when the idea that I have is good enough to carry an entire piece. And like you said, it can be a sound that I'm creating. So I feel like a sculptor, I'm sculpting the sound world. It could just be an interval or a particular rhythm. But while I work for hours and hours, and I don't stop until I hit that moment when I know, okay, this idea is good enough to carry a piece. And it's usually no longer than maybe 10 seconds of music, and then I stop. Because I know the next time I come back to it, I'm going to be sitting there and I'm not going to be able to tear myself away. So I'm going to start neglecting all the things that really need to happen.
I think one thing you do so well in this collection, again, we're talking about the CD Driving at Night. I'll look at the 6 a.m. track as an example of starting off in a place and really taking your time to get from point A to point B in a way that enables me as a listener to customize myself to the soundscape that's being created there. That takes some discipline, I imagine, because you've been living with these things for hours and hours.
One thing that I think I've always felt like set me apart as a composer, and it's something that I try to use to my advantage, is this idea of pacing, knowing how long something needs to go on for before I need to introduce something new. And then knowing when to stop. I sit there a lot and I listen over and over again. And I try to feel, has it gone on long enough? Does it need a little bit more? Should I add something new? And just in the same way, instead of adding something, 6 a.m., for example, it starts not very front-loaded. The bass or the low end doesn't really come in until further into the piece. And that's something that, again, one of my instructors during my doctorate would always say, withholding something is just as powerful as adding something.
Now, a time that you're very familiar with, I'm sure, meeting deadlines in these compositions, 3 a.m. And should point out that the pieces begin with 11:55 p.m. and go through the wee hours of the morning and arrive at 6:01 a.m. when your alarm clock goes off, I imagine. But 3 a.m., and this features yourself performing on violin. Talk me through this work.
I wanted to have somebody else perform it, but I really just felt that nobody could quite play it the way I heard it in my mind, so I decided to go ahead and record it myself. Originally, the piece was actually supposed to be a funeral march that was written for piano and kind of organ sounds for a TV job. They didn't end up buying it, or they didn't need it. So then I had a grandmother pass away, and our family have 7 siblings, and we all play musical instruments, and we were going to perform a piece for the funeral, so I rewrote the piece for that occasion with a completely odd set of instruments, and I just never could quite let go of that music, and I decided to incorporate it into this album. I felt like it was a great kind of hearkening to the past, but kind of bringing it into the present.
Composer and violinist Daniel Pappas. His new CD is Driving at Night, and you'll find links at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. Well, that's all for today's show. You'll find archived episodes and podcasts at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. If you'd like to send us your suggestions, comments, or questions, you may do so at triadarts@wfu.edu. Our technical producer is Eddie Garcia. Our associate producer is Bethany Chafin. And I'm David Ford. Thanks for listening to Triad Arts Weekend.